To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Dig Deep Grow. This is Michael McAvoy. I'm your host. We are live. And the Dig Deep Grow is the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. We're going to be talking about a subject today that affects everyone, and that is your future and where finance fits into that. Now, our audience, we're all dedicated to doing the best that we can. That's the peak potential nature of who we are. And so I've invited Alan Beaulieu, who's just completed a new book called Prosperity in the Age of Decline. Alan is an economist, so he's I'm going to ask him how many years he's been doing this, but I imagine he's been doing it for quite a long time. The aim of the show is to help equip you with the tools that you'll need in order to weather what Alan sees as a storm coming, so in your financial life. So without ado, I'd like to introduce Alan Beaulieu. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
My pleasure, Michael. It's great to be with you on the show. I certainly like the premise.
Yeah, it's a good show. Good show. We have a good audience, too. So they'll be very interested in what you have to say. Let's start, Alan, with your background and how long you've been in the area of economics.
Okay, sure. ITR Economics, the firm, has been around since the 1940s. My brother and I are the current principals. I've been here since December 1989. My brother has been here since 1983, so he has seniority. And we together wrote this book called Prosperity in the Age of Decline. We, as an economic consulting firm, have offices in Europe and in the U.S. Clients that span the globe, offer a broad perspective, and we get down into where individual companies will be going based upon what the economy is doing. So it's an interesting practice, and we thoroughly enjoy what we do.
Great. Thank you for the introduction. You know, there in looking through the book, one thing that caught my interest was that you do advertise or publish your rate of accuracy with your predictions. So I'd like to ask you to just talk about that a minute, just so we know where you're coming from and how you come to your conclusions.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Michael, and probably the most salient of them all. We actually know that's the number one question people have when they talk to economists, or is really in the back of their mind, are you any good at your job? So it's the number one question. We have a 94.7% through time, decades, and the reason for that is its foundation rests on some cyclical theories developed by the company founder, Chapin Hoskins. He deserves the academic credit. And Brian and I have continued that work from Chapin, and it undergirds that which we do. In simple terms, and we never get into the details of the theory for obvious reasons, it's our black box, but the theories also incorporate what's happening in terms of key leading indicators, which we discuss in the book, and we discuss amongst ourselves here at the office what the implications are of the economy of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, as an example, or terrorism activity, insurgent activity in Iraq, and what that might do. So we look into theory, we look at leading indicators, which are totally impartial, and we look at what's happening in the world to see if there's any immediate impact. And those three things together have given us that accuracy rate that you were nice enough to bring up, and I'm certainly happy to talk about.
Sure.
We also make sure that we let folks know that we do not update a forecast unless it needs it. Our goal is to let our clients have an accurate forecast for as long as we can. For instance, some firms update their forecast monthly, so you never really know, you never really get that sense of confidence that there is a forecast, and that 94.7% is 12 months out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only 94.7, but you can know with that kind of confidence a year in advance what's going to be happening in China, the U.S., Europe, et cetera,
okay.
As well as industries underneath that.
Okay, well, just so you know, and so you can answer your questions along these lines, our audience would be the average person, obviously, who holds a job, works for a company, and is interested in protecting themselves and making sure that they have a prosperous future. So the other group are entrepreneurs, business owners, who might take more of a deeper interest in some of the stats that you mentioned, one being demographics, for example, in your book. So the first question I'll ask you is, for the person, the average person who really can't delve into all of the statistics that you do in order to come up with your predictions, what do you suggest? Give an overview right now of the current state of affairs in the United States as well as the world, and how things have transformed over the last 5 years, we'll say.
Okay, two questions. Let me tackle the first one in terms of where we're at now in the U.S. and globally. And the answer is, in the U.S., we're in pretty good shape here. And I say that with a smile on my face. The U.S. is growing in terms of GDP, and to me, growth is a technical term. We're at record high levels of GDP. We're at record high levels of private sector employment, retail sales, industrial production. Manufacturing as a percent of GDP is growing larger again. Firms are coming back to the United States. If you wanted to be at a sweet spot where you can count on a lot of good things going on and carrying you forward for a few years, this is it. Really, there aren't a lot of negatives in the world right now. China makes most people nervous, and that's understandable. Europe is going to sag, and that's too bad. And, it'll cost some people their jobs. But it's not going to derail the U.S. It's just going to slow us down a little bit. The U.S. is an amazing economy right now, Michael, and it has to do with energy. It has to do with productivity gains. It has to do with stability. There's just a lot right. And, one of the things that drives me, gets me up every day, is that I get to tell people about that because we're bombarded with what's wrong. And every once in a while, it's nice to hear what's going on right in this country. Consumers are in great shape. Your listeners are probably among those consumers. They're not behind in their debts. Delinquency rates nationally are well below 10-year averages. We're saving money, 4% or so savings rate. We are people who know how to spend. We've kind of balanced our life. And those are all real positive things for us as we go forward. Not that we don't have problems which are going to lead us to a Great Depression, but you asked a question that was couched in the near term, and in the near term, it's going to look good. It's actually going to lull a lot of folks into a sense of complacency, mm-hmm. and more importantly, perhaps our leadership, political leadership, into a sense of complacency that's going to sort of set us up for failure for later.
Yeah, that's interesting the way that you put that answer, because honestly, most authors or books that I've read with the idea of a downturn or a depression or something like that, it's pretty glum all the way through. When you started your answer, I was like, wow, this does not sound like the book.
we have a section on there on the near term,
okay.
Which is upbeat.
That's good. All right, so we all know that at least in the next few years, things are going to be okay. I personally, I'm a little concerned because with the after the 2008 downturn, there's been a recovery, and the government's done a lot to see to it that we're kind of keeping our legs with the economy. But I have this feeling that it's all kind of a little bit artificial, and it's being propped up somewhat. I don't know if you see that as an economist, but a lot of people that I speak to have that kind of gut feeling that we haven't quite turned around fully.
Sure. Two things come to mind. One is I think you're giving way too much credit to the government for propping things up and turning things around.
Mm-hmm.
More often than not, a lot of those actions just sort of get in the way of dealing with problems. What would be a polite way of putting it? I mean, if you have a problem that needs to be dealt with, you have a choice. You can either mask it and kind of hope it gets better on its own, or you can expose the ugliness of it and take out the the cancer or whatever it happens to be. The government has a great tendency to want to mask things over and kind of prop things up, which is where you were going with it, but they're not terribly good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of this growth that I've been talking about is because private industry has come around. It's not because the stock market's been pumped up by quantitative easing. It's because businesses are making more. Businesses are selling more.
Okay.
Businesses in the U.S. are competing more globally, and that has nothing to do with what the government's been doing. It has to do with what business has been doing.
So,
which leads me, by the way, we tend towards the Austrian school of economic thought.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how familiar you are with Austrian versus Keynesian, but you'll definitely find us on the Austrian-leaning side of the ledger, which I automatically tip my hat towards business and have a raised eyebrow when it comes to big government, big spending programs, and making everything all right for everybody.
Well, I do agree with you there, but I'll follow up, you know, about this quantitative easing. You know, if the Federal Reserve is pumping tens of billions of dollars into the economy every month, it's hard to believe that it's not finding its way, you know, into a more flush-feeling population, maybe believing that they're wealthier than they really are, and, you know, spending is up and all that kind of thing because of it. You have a comment on that?
Sure. Most of the cash did not get out into the public. The excess capital reserves by lending institutions, banks, commercial banks, ballooned through the same time period because people were not going to the banks to borrow it. They weren't borrowing for loan originations for homes, for instance, in the first quarter was at a 14-year low, but it was going down before then. You can't blame all that on winter. Commercial borrowing. Businesses have so much cash of their own and enough going on that they have not run to the banks even at these very low interest rates. So the cash has been building up behind this wall called capital reserves. It's right now at, if I remember the number correctly, it's right around $1.7 trillion in excess capital reserves, which is more than, say, just so you have it in context, that's more than the GDP for the year for Canada. So our banks are holding more cash idle, looking for something to do, than Canada produces in a year. So the cash did not find its way to Main Street.
Okay.
Still sitting on Banking Street.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But so this is real economy. This is good stuff.
Well, that's a great picture then, because you know, at least in the short term, for the next did you say several years that we're good?
Yeah.
Okay. Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. Now, give some background now to why things are going to change and what we should be doing with preparation in the future, especially with our finances.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's going to change slowly, which is you know, kind of obvious, but let me, you know, slowly at first, and then everything kind of gains momentum as we go along. But what's going to happen first is you're going to find some wage inflation going on in the United States because skilled labor is going to get harder to find. You have 10,000 senior Americans retiring on average every day, creating job openings. We don't like immigration in this country, so we're not going to backfill with immigration. And a lot of the skill sets that we need in distribution and in factories and in the supply chain are not there. We're going to have to spend money training them. We're going to have to spend money poaching from each other. And that wage inflation is just beginning now, but it has begun. And that's sort of like the match to a fire.
Mm-hmm.
You need a fuel for fire, and that fuel is all that quantitative easing sitting around. There's all kinds of cash sitting around. And that's like gasoline just kind of sloshing around waiting to be lit off.
Mm-hmm.
So when all of a sudden consumers are making more, they start spending more, and that starts an upward spiral of inflation, which is going to be gentle enough at first, 2.5%, 2.75% a year, 3%. And then, you know, but it's like a little leaven. It you know, goes through the whole lump, and this is just going to start an upward cycle until we find ourselves thinking it's the 1970s. I'm not sure how. I have no idea how old you are, Michael, but it's going to be a lot like the 1970s. And then before you know it, in 15 years, it's going to be like the Carter years, which your older listeners just went, oh, my gosh, I don't want that again.
Mm-hmm.
double-digit interest rates and high inflation.
There's a pretty big difference even there, I would, in my estimation. The inflation obviously is going to, if you're saying that it's coming, it's going to be similar. The only difference is, I think, on the last time that this happened, the United States was a creditor nation and not a debtor nation. How is that going to play out?
Well, it's going to play out in a large way, because in the early 1980s, we just had a significant recession to cure the inflation illness. But when you're a debtor nation, as the U.S. is, it's going to turn it a great recession into a great depression. The third leg of that stool is demographics, which we haven't gotten to. If I may, I'm going to take you back to the inflation thing for just a minute, because your B question earlier was, what do you do about it?
Yes.
What you do is you think of inflation-adjusted assets and how you can invest in those as you go forward. And for a lot of your entrepreneurs who are listening, Michael, that's their own businesses, because they'll be able to raise their revenue stream because they'll raise prices in inflation. So the more they invest in efficiencies, the more they invest in what's going to make them smarter, better, faster, and with borrowed money, which is the way to do it, the more that they will reap the benefit as they go on. And borrowed money, because you're going to pay it back with inflated dollars, which from Econ 101 classes, you know, most people remember that's a huge win. So that's how you take advantage of it. Or real estate, especially near mountains and water, because of the amount of people retiring, they're going to want those properties. Or rental properties, because the amount of young people who can't afford homes. So there was those very good ways to take advantage of this good news, or bad news, excuse me, and turn it into good news. And then in the book, we also discuss specific funds and some specific areas for other investments that we think this inflation, which typically robs people of a standard of living, if you know it's coming and do it right, will greatly enhance your wealth-creating ability so that you're ahead of the inflation curve, which is obviously a big win. It's what everybody wants to do. So before we get to the debt, I wanted to make sure we finished up on that. Sorry.
Okay.
About that.
Yeah, and I'll give you one follow-up since you mentioned it. A majority of people will invest a portion of their savings and retirement into the stock market and bonds, for instance. These are the two major classes of investments that are probably the most invested in. What would you say about each of those in an inflationary period?
Well, in the inflationary period that's coming, interest rates will be going up, which means you want to hold a bond to maturity and hold a bond whose stated interest rate is above the average inflation rate. So you're looking at munis, or you're looking at bonds with, you know, a minimal risk. But if you're going to get into a bond fund, you're likely to see principal erosion, unless it's a short-term or laddered bond fund. As far as equities goes, yeah, we're fine with equities. There's going to be the corrections. There'll be the occasional crash. I in no way want to try to forecast or time those, because that's a great way to be wrong.
Yeah.
But the reality is, I think equities will give a nice return on investment. And the older your listener, the more you're going to think like me, which is in terms of what's a decent stock that has a good dividend yield that's likely to also increase with inflation, and you're adjusted and protected that way while riding the upside.
Okay. Do you have an example of a fund, a stock fund, that would fit into that description?
Well, we have a number of them in the book, and I think the opportunities will be there, and we name some names and stuff in there. But if you look into the different funds that deal with commodity prices, for instance, and if you deal with funds that are dealing with efficient use of raw materials, even water, you're going to find that there are some opportunities for making money in an inflationary period, and good opportunities. We're going to see better than average returns in those areas.
Okay.
When you get to your second question about debt, I'd like to talk near-term and long-term there, too. Through the near-term, we can successfully kick this can down the road because Dr. Bernanke did such a great job securing long-term 10-year financing for us at record low rates. I mean, his timing was impeccable, and it's saving us billions of dollars through the years, lots of money. Did a nice job. And because it's a relatively small percent of the U.S. GDP going towards interest payments, it looks like it's a non-issue. The trouble comes in that interest rates will be going up. There's nobody I've talked to that doesn't think interest rates are going up. The Federal Open Market Committee says interest rates are going up. Congressional Budget Office is projecting that interest rates are going up. We certainly are. And at the same time, the CBO is estimating that we will be adding, on average, $1 trillion a year to the U.S. debt over the next 15 years, actually between now and 2038, which is more than 15 years. We're going to find ourselves narrowing the budget gap through the near term with very low interest rates. It's going to make people feel good, to your point earlier in our conversation. It's going to make people complacent, which is part of my input into the conversation earlier. And that complacency, that feel good, is going to allow us to spend. It's not really a problem. What are all these people worried about? Then interest rates begin to pop, and we're back to $1 trillion a year. And next thing you know, the gap is widening, and we go from $18 trillion, and all of a sudden it's $20 trillion, then it's $23 trillion. And their projection is that it's over $30 trillion in debt in the 2030s. And that at conservative interest rates, that will consume 25% of the federal budget just in interest payments.
So
that's a significant problem.
Yeah, and so you put it out, you know, well into the future. I've heard that there are other prognosticators and economists that will say there will be some sort of a shock or a surprise. You know, we might be in a slightly inflationary period, and then there'd be some shock that would jolt the confidence of the bond holders. Do you think that there's a likelihood that instead of it being a gradual thing that takes up to a couple of decades to happen, that we could find ourselves in what would be a crisis, you know, by any other definition?
Sure. I gave you the CBO estimate at a couple of decades. Our own here at ITR is 15 years, 2030-ish,
okay,
plus or minus, with the shorter term. But to answer your question directly, absolutely there can be things that happen that strike fear into the heart of the bond market. The big question, obviously, is what will those things be? And if I knew that, I'd have a great crystal ball. But you're right. Things could happen which exacerbate it, make it happen faster, accelerate it. I'm at a loss as to what it could be. It's not a terrorist event. That doesn't shake the financial roots and the economic roots of the nation. That just shakes up our psychology.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as terrible as that would be. It's as terrible as an assassination would be. That's never enough. It would have to be, I don't know what it would have to be.
Okay.
Which is why we're forecasting that's more gradual.
maybe if I was going to say something, a world war or, you know, some conflict that, you know, just rages on for years, I don't know. There's other countries that have been in doing the same thing the United States has in terms of with using quantitative easing and the like. I guess the confidence issue, what would trigger that? I'm not sure, but it's good to hear that you don't have an answer as an economist. So that gives me a little bit of faith in the future. So let's just assume that it is a gradual thing. Does that mean that the Congress and the government can go on, you know, appropriating more funds for this or that, building the deficit as they have without any kind of austerity or planning? Or have you built that into your model?
Well, it doesn't mean that they can, but it means that they will. I'm going to change can to should. Should they do what you said? Absolutely not. That is the wrong approach, and it will bring us to a Great Depression. Will they do it? Absolutely, because it'll be gradual. We as a people have a great confidence in addressing our concerns under a period of crisis. We don't feel a sense of crisis about this. We have people on the edge and creeping even towards the middle who are saying this is a growing problem. But really, as the years go by and people keep saying it's a problem, it becomes just background noise and easier to ignore. So I think America will want to believe the people who say this is not a problem. They're going to want to believe a Congress who says, you know, we can deal with this, even though they don't deal with it. And I think as a result, we're going to have this problem comes slowly and steadily towards us until it is too late to do anything about it. and at which time austerity will have to be embraced by the federal government, and austerity is always painful. There's no time that it's not painful, and as its pain is realized in spending cuts, that obviously slows down the economy and has a negative impact on GDP, while inflation has to be dealt with through the sharper increases in interest rates, a la the Carter years, which will be late in the 2020s. So consumer spending is cut back, business spending is cut back, and government spending is all cut back at the same time, which causes the economy to tumble,
mm-hmm.
and tumble quickly in what we think into a Great Depression because of the third leg, which we have not talked about, which is demographics. Before we go there, if I may, I just want to also say that the United States is not the only nation with a debt problem. You know that,
yes.
And I'm sure most of the listeners know that, but we need to acknowledge then that this is going to be a global problem, not just a U.S. problem. The worst nation on the planet with a debt problem by our analysis, which we detail in the text, is Japan, which sounds like it's not our problem until we realize that Japan is the second largest holder of U.S. treasuries. And as such, as they need to convert treasuries to yen, they sell treasuries. A big holder of treasuries starts selling, and all of a sudden you find yourself with downward pressure on the dollar, upward pressure on interest rates, and things can get more difficult rather quickly. If you remember the ruble crisis, Michael, that's a extreme case, because the United States is not Russia, but gives you an idea of how the mechanism works and the kind of pressures that we could be facing. So Japan's problem is our problem.
Okay.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, using Japan as an example, you're looking a couple of decades out, but my read on Japan is that things are going to happen a lot sooner in Japan because they're further on down the road than we are. And so, you know, when the proverbial S hits the fan, when's that going to happen for Japan? And could it be, you know, could it mean something more near term for us?
I think it could, to answer your question. Absolutely, it could. I would not want to say otherwise. But what I think it plays out is that it adds to the inflationary pressures of the U.S. in the 2020s, because the scenario I described will happen before the U.S. Remember I said that it causes downward pressure on the dollar, upward pressure on interest rates, but that's because it brings on inflationary pressures to the U.S. also.
Mm-hmm.
We have to raise interest rates to attract people to the dollar, but it also means a weaker dollar means everything costs more, and that's inflationary. And that inflation acceleration in the 2020s that we talk about, I think, is caused by Japan, and they are a reason for that inflation coming about, which is at one time very helpful if you're invested right, and another time very painful if you're on a fixed income or out of position. So I agree with you. I think they're going to happen sooner, and it's hard to imagine them not having this in front of them given their demographic position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Japan, by the way, it's Great Britain, then it's the U.S., according to our analysis.
Okay, in that order. Yeah.
Yep.
So I'll ask you, that's a good transition into the demographics, because my read of it is that this is probably the biggest contributor that nobody can stop. So I think that's, you should probably give a little bit of background on why that's so important and why you mentioned that certain countries are on a cliff with that versus others.
Sure, I'll be happy to. Let's start with the why. If you have a dwindling or a stagnant workforce, labor force, you have limited the amount of tax revenue that will come into the central government, what we call federal government here. Central governments in most places, and the only way that you can then take care of more and more people who are retiring into what we call Social Security and Medicare, prescription drug programs, would be to have more workers so that you broaden the base, or you raise their taxes because you need to support these older people. You have a contract with them. You have made them promises, and you don't want to break those promises because those people have been known to vote. As they vote, elected leaders hate to really disappoint them. So they go after younger people or businesses. For your entrepreneurs and business folks who are listening, they are a prime target and are at risk as we go forward, because I think the softest target out there as we go through the next 15 years will be business, and that the mantra that wealthy people and businesses do not pay their fair share of taxes, I think it's only going to increase. I think the volume is going to get louder. And the rate can go down. The corporate tax rate can go from 35% to 30%, and Congress and the President can take a bow. But if they lop off deductions and exemptions, but they like to call loopholes, but they're really not. That term really irks me. But as they lop those things off, your effective rate can go up. Now, it would be good if large corporations pay 30% and who right now pay nothing, or 10%. But I think small businesses, medium-sized businesses, are going to find this a painful process to go through with very little relief. And so their cash flow will be impinged upon by higher taxes. And that's going to happen in Japan. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I think a lot of the businesses are going to leave Japan, and they will just set up shop offshore. Not so much in the United States, but Japan. There's not much incentive as the labor force dwindles every year from a lack of children. They forgot to have children a generation ago. And so they are heading towards a pensioned economy at a very fast pace without an immigration flow behind it. So when you have in the United States, we have a stable labor force. I mean, it's not that it is shrinking as it is in Russia, as it is in Japan. We are stable with a fertility rate, just to give you the number, it's about 1.96, and the magic number is 2.1. So we're almost at stable, which is good. It's just that the 10,000 people retiring a day, all with their hands out, somebody's got to pay them. And that means more government borrowing, or it means more taxes, or a combination of the two.
You mentioned a point there about small businesses or businesses of all kind. Why, on the one hand, would it be a good thing for a business to be in control of their destiny in the decades ahead, and at the same time saying that they're going to get squeezed because of increased taxes with trying to deal with the debt? So, is it which way would you want to be on that side of the coin? You know.
Well, if I could be politically active and try to do my best to keep, as a small business owner, my taxes minimized or kept on a level playing field, I would certainly do that. I would be actively involved in whatever organizations, through my trade association or an NFIB or whatever it happens to be that your listeners are affiliated with, put the pressure on Congress. But perhaps more importantly is to drive the efficiencies that we talked about earlier. And a lot of these taxes, I think, are going to come through payroll taxes and through healthcare taxes. So the more that your listeners, my readers, are able to drive those efficiencies so that we hire only as absolutely necessary, we only hire when necessary, other than that we outsource, other than that we have a machine, other than that we have a new system, new process, the more that we keep the headcount down, the better our cash flow as we go forward in an inflationary environment.
Okay.
That will be extremely important.
Yeah, so it brings up, and this also has to do with demographics, the combination of what's happening with technology, automation, robots, the things that are basically jobs are going away that are never going to come back. So not for business owners, but for the average person who works for corporate America, is there likely to be even a more difficult period coming up with just getting employed?
Not if the technological skills are sharp, and if they're listening to your program, they're probably of that mindset. It'll be harder to get a job that pays enough to get by if there's no marketable skill. I'll tell you a quick story if you don't mind. I remember taking some of our younger economists with me to a client who's a distributor of CNC equipment and different machinery for different applications, but it's basically CNC. And I love those things. I mean, I just could stand there and watch that type of process all day long. And as I took them around, they had not seen them before, so it was educational. And then they found out how much those people got paid. They needed a year or two of post-high school education. They needed good math skills. They needed problem-solving skills. They needed, sort of an engineering bent. And then they found out that people with that 1 to 2 years made more than they did with a 4 or 5 year degree, just because they can get it, because the skill set is good, but it's rare. I think your listeners are probably in that skill set. I mean, educated in the medical, educated in engineering, educated in the environmental sciences, all going to be demanded. So,
what was the what was that acronym for our listeners?
Sorry, it's the computer controlled equipment.
Okay.
It's what used to be done on a single stream lathe is now done on with four axes, and a piece of material is processed through and made into a part in almost no time with almost no waste. It's mostly driven by computer with a human overseer.
Okay.
So that human can oversee four computers and machines.
Okay.
CNC.
All right. So we were on demographics. So you mentioned that Japan, Great Britain, and U.S. that there would be that we would be affected in that order because of changes in demographics. So go into a little more detail about the world, which populations are going to be thriving, which populations may not in that scenario.
Okay. Just a slight, just to make sure I haven't misled anybody here, the demographics of the U.S. are actually pretty healthy. If it wasn't for our silly debt level, and that crushing load that it will present, we probably wouldn't be in, well, I know we would not be mathematically in nearly as much difficulty with the demographic pain that's coming. 10,000 people a day, doubling the amount of retirees would be a lot more manageable if we weren't adding $1 trillion a year on average going forward. But to answer your question, out of whack for health for the future. That's a significant problem as they look at an aging population. China, their one-child policy with gender selection created way too many single males with no single females. And it's, you know, that's not an easy problem to overcome. You either export the males or you import females. Otherwise, you end up with slow growth and instability. The sociologists will tell you some violence, some crime. This is not healthy. When you look at what's happening in Germany, very little little growth in the way of children. The demographic number there, the fertility rate is 1.4. And they know that it's a bad number. They absolutely know that this is bad for the future, but they can't get people to procreate and want to have more children, more than 1.4 on average per woman in her childbearing years, which is what fertility rate is. It's one of those situations where a nation can know, but you can't make people have children.
Okay. So give
that's a real problem. It's a global problem.
It is, yeah. But if you just take a snapshot of the year 2030, what are the countries that will be at the top of the heap, so to speak? And, you know, what will the world look like in 2030?
Well, you're going to look at a global depression only because the three major players will all be in tumbling downward. The U.S., for the reasons we've discussed, Europe still has a debt problem, although not as large as the U.S. Their demographic problems were. So in combination, they're tumbling down as well. And China, too, which we haven't discussed a lot of their problems other than demographics, but China's got its problems. So the three main drivers of the global economy are all going to be timing out. Well, Japan has already timed out, the third largest economy in the world. So you're looking at a scenario where it's just going to impact everybody. So the answer to the question, Michael, is who is impacted the least as opposed to who escapes it. And the answer, we believe, is going to be found in Mexico, Australia, and South America.
Interesting. I would have thought India would have been in that picture, but is there...
Not for me.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. It wouldn't be because of demographics. It must be something else because they're a very young country, correct?
They are young, although they are beginning to flirt around with a one-child policy, which in the course of 15 years can have a negative impact because they're worried about population growth. But their problems are more systemic in terms of environmental mess. It's systemic in terms of political slowness, and they really need to develop some forward momentum and stability in the political world to attract some foreign direct investment.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, this really isn't popular to say, and you got to be careful. But culturally, it's not open and conducive, I should say, to a lot of foreign direct investment either. There's cultural concerns that can keep the economy from growing as fast as it might in another nation.
Mm-hmm.
because it's harder to clean up the environment. It's harder to deal with some fundamental issues, and it's culturally ingrained, and that makes it very difficult. No disrespect intended. It just seems to be the reality.
Yeah. Well, the book is called Prosperity in the Age of Decline. I'm speaking with Alan Bouilliau. And Alan, we have time for a couple more questions. I think the burning question that wants to be answered, I think, by our listeners is, what do I do now to plan for the future?
A great question. And yeah, it would be the burning one if I were listening too. What I would do first off is set strategic growth goals for the near term. You don't want to be so worried about the Great Depression that you miss the growth of the near term. That would be a catastrophic mistake that you could never catch up on. So grab the growth while you can. That's number one. Number two is you have to make sure you're gearing your life so that you are out of debt, every form of debt that you can think of, out of debt by the late 2020s. Because as interest rates are climbing, you certainly don't want any variable debt. You want to make sure you're well clear of that. And you want to make sure as the nation tips over into a Great Depression that you don't have any debt. Your home, for instance, your car, because something that you don't owe on can't be repossessed or taken away from you. And as far as paying the taxes on your home, that you can do that out of savings. You could do that out of your dividends. You could do that out of your retirement fund. That's a whole lot easier, and it takes years to foreclose on you or take away your home for taxes. So the reality is no mortgage, no credit card debt, nothing like that, and you'll survive this whole process a whole lot easier. But don't worry about it now. You worry about it in about 10 years from now when interest rates start getting a little more nuts. And then by the end of the 2020s, you certainly don't want to be carrying any flexible variable debt.
I'll play devil's advocate. I think if you have a fixed rate mortgage at today's levels, that would be a good thing, right?
Absolutely. And for you and I, it's not an issue. What I tell my grown children is, if you're going to carry a fixed mortgage into the future, that's fine as long as you think you'll have enough cash reserves so that if you lose your job, you can continue to make the mortgage payments. You just have to make sure you have years' worth of mortgage payments built up in case something really bad happens to your income stream.
So for a family starting out, would you ever counsel not to own a home, maybe to rent? Where would you come down on that equation?
I always come down on the side of if you can get a home now that you will be satisfied living in for the next 20 plus years and can do all of this on a 20-year mortgage, preferably a 15-year, but grant you the 20-year, do it. No hesitation because it'll grow in value because of the inflation and you'll have a home that you will own. But if you can't see yourself staying put, and if you can't see yourself qualifying in the next 5 or 7 years, just rent a nice home and ride this thing out. Rental prices will go down in the Great Depression, and you'll be able to just live comfortably.
Well, those are all very good practical answers, Alan. I appreciate that you came on today to enlighten us as to what's happening in the future. With a 95% accuracy rate, I think that we should all be doing some planning. The book is called Prosperity in the Age of Decline. And in the book, I don't think we mentioned it, but there's are chapters that are very specific about the things that you can do in order to plan. So although Alan's been very gracious with his answers, there's a lot more depth in the book. So you can pick this up at major booksellers, Amazon.com and the like. And Alan, I don't know if there's any last words. Is there a question that I should have asked you that I didn't?
Well, Barnes & Noble is stocking, if I may add that in there. They've added it to 400 of their bookstores, and which has been very nice. That doesn't happen much anymore. I guess the last question would be, is also what's the last chapter? Is there hope? Are there things that can change this? Or is this fate? Is this inescapable? And we do address that. And the answer is, given everything we know now and given available knowledge now and political considerations, the way that we see them unfolding in the years to come, while it's not fate, we believe that it's next to unstoppable. The worst case is that it lasts longer and steeper than we're forecasting in the book. Best case is it's still a very serious recession. in that time period. So either way, there's something to get ready for. The only thing you could hope for, well, that's a terrible way to put it, so forgive me for the hope for. The only thing that could happen, which would change this, is if the senior citizens of the world, baby boomers, I'm a baby boomer, all of a sudden something happens that we died a lot younger than actuaries think we're going to die. Mm-hmm. If we don't make it to 82, we don't make it to 86. My brother would say if we start a war involving only old people, that would take care of the problem. Barring something like that, we're in for a storm. And the best thing we can do is get ready.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your candor and your looking at both sides equally. You know, the cup is half full now, and so we should be taking advantage of that. Alan, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
Okay.